Hello, nice to have you back and welcome to Mimbar. One of the main sources of religious intolerance is the tendency towards religious exclusivism by the followers of different religious faiths. One type of this exclusivism is what is called supersessionism, an attitude or belief that holds that a particular religion nullifies those that came before or after it, even if the religion prior to it was considered to have been divinely sent. This tendency is especially noted among some of the followers of the Abrahamic religions, such as Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Many of us have heard some Muslims or Christians saying that the other group would go to hell if they did not accept the oneness of Allah and the prophethood of Muhammad, or if you didn't accept Jesus Christ as your Lord and personal Savior. Or in the case of Judaism, they simply ignore the other religions, at least, or attack Christianity as a false religion. Is Islam supersessionist and therefore exclusivist and intolerant? To what extent is it? Here to address these questions, we have as our guest, Mr. Muhammad Saeed Bahmanpour. Mr. Bahmanpour is the director of the Islamic College for Advanced Studies of England and a screenwriter of the acclaimed films Saint Mary and the People of the Cave. Let's take a look.
Welcome.
Thank you very much, and salam and peace to you and to all the viewers.
Thank you very much. Now, supersessionism. Could you give me a... What is the meaning of supersessionism?
Well, this, as you said, this is a big term. It's a coined term. It means that it refers to the idea that the believers and followers of every faith would regard or might regard their faith to supersede other religions. In a sense, this talks about faiths which, to some extent, accept each other. For example, Christianity to some extent accepts Judaism as its history, as its background, as its tradition. However, there is that idea that after Jesus Christ came, it superseded everything which went before it. Or take the example of Islam, for example. The Muslims believe that, of course, the roots of Islam is in other Abrahamic faiths, is in Judaism, Christianity. It is a continuation of those faiths. However, there is this common idea that since those books who came before Islam were distorted, then Islam supersedes those faiths. And therefore comes the term supersessionism, which of course have lots of theological indications and theological repercussions, if you like.
Mm-hmm. Now, so does supersession mean, for example, exclusivism? When we say supersede, do we mean by supersede cancel another religion out? Or does it mean, for example, take a higher priority over? It doesn't neglect it completely, it doesn't reject it completely, but it takes a higher priority over. Is it a question of canceling out or becoming more important than?
Well, in a sense, one of the implications of supersessionism for those who believe in it is that it completely cancels out the previous religion. In a sense, if a part of religion is distorted, or if it is already cancelled or abrogated by a new prophet, then all that faith would be useless and everyone should enter into the fold and bosom of the new faith and new religion. So this is the meaning of supersessionism. However, the big discussion is who believes in that, whether we Muslims believe in that, whether Jews or Christians believe in that. This is a big discussion. And of course, what are the theological implications of that? Does that mean that if anyone who accepts supersessionism would believe that, for example, the followers of all other faiths would go to hell, or, of course, not put it in this very dramatic way, yeah, would not find salvation?
Okay, we get to that. But when you were talking about supersessionism, I immediately started to think about the different aspects of religion. For example, in religion we have, for example, the doctrinal aspect. You know, belief in, for example, heaven, hell, reincarnation maybe, prophethood, the oneness of God and so on. Then we have the other aspect of prophethood. Who is the prophet? Who is the bringer of that religion? And then we have the aspect of law. Is supersessionism something absolute in the sense that supersessionism means abrogating everything, including doctrine, including the prophethood of somebody? Or does it, for example, take the form of a legal aspect, which you find in modern society? You know, you have the law, you have a constitution, and you have abrogations to that law and to that constitution. Is supersession, therefore, in short, something absolute, or is something particular to the law, for example?
Well, let's talk about Abrahamic faiths, for example.
Right.
Certainly, there are injunctions in the Bible which are agreeable to the Quran. Or there are lots of doctrinal issues in Judaism or even in Christianity. Put aside, of course, Trinity, which is not acceptable to Islam by any way. But there are many other doctrinal aspects, like, for example, the doctrine of the hereafter, paradise and hell. These things are certainly accepted by all these faiths. However, supersessionism says that it doesn't matter if some parts of these ideas are already found in those previous faiths. Since a new prophet has come, you have to believe in him to find salvation. In a way, you are rejecting a truth which is not susceptible to be rejected. You cannot afford to reject this and find salvation. This is the whole idea of supersessionism. And we can look at it from a different angle as well. Religions usually talk about the real, talk about the truth. And therefore, when you have this idea of the real, the truth, you have to reject relativism.
Right.
And if you reject relativism, you cannot accept parallel faiths or parallel ideas to run side by side beside each other, and therefore you have to reject all others except your own.
Now, it seems that what you're saying, that in the whole idea of supersessionism, there is a very important contradiction, especially for, again, people who belong to the same grouping of faith. Take, for example, you have a Christian who says, yes, Moses was a real and true prophet, and he brought a truth, or the truth. And in among the expressions of that truth is, for example, there's one true God who manifests himself in history. Then you say now that I reject, with supersessionism, I reject this faith completely, meaning that you're also rejecting the transcendental truth brought by that religion, and I accept a new dispensation, a new truth, which has many elements of the previous one. It seems to me a sort of a inconsistency here, because I think the intellect of man can separate, for example, the universal from the particular.
Yes. Well, in the case of Christianity and Judaism, the idea is very strong. Let's talk about Christianity first. Of course, the Christians say there were many prophets who went before the coming of Jesus Christ. But after God sent his son to redeem the people, this was a new watershed. It was something completely unique. And therefore, everything that went before it is not something that we have to stick to. And that's why the law of Moses, the law of the book, is not respected or not committed to in Christianity. Of course, they believe that people who went before Jesus Christ, they were prophets. They spoke truth. They spoke on the authority of God. However, after God sent his son, then everyone should believe in his son, should believe in the redeeming power, the power of redemption vested in him by God, and, well, leave everything aside. You have to believe in Jesus Christ, and that's all.
Right.
And that supersedes everything which went before it.
Right.
And in this way, the idea of unity of God, which was certainly very, very prominent in Judaism, the idea of the law, the worship, and all these things are superseded by the coming of Jesus Christ. In Judaism, the idea was very strong, which is of course brought up in the Quran as a reference to Jews and as a type of dialogue and discussion that Prophet had with the Jews of his own time, which reflects the idea of Jews of that time and before that era, that the Jews regarded every other faith except their own faith to be completely unacceptable.
This is interesting because, I mean, the meaning of supersede, one gets the impression that of something that comes after, superseding something that came before,
yes.
Something coming after, replacing or removing something that came before. Here we have Judaism that is not a supersession, more like a future session.
Well, you can put it like that, but of course there were lots of religions at the time of Moses,
right.
And there were prophets who went before Moses, right. As well. What mainly came into that supersessionism of Judaism was that the religion is confined and defined in the children of Israel, and anyone outside this wouldn't have any right religion. And this is what Quran refers to very much. Usually there is a term in the Quran which is usually misinterpreted or mistranslated, and that's the term ummi. Ummi, usually we translate it or interpret it in different translations of the Quran as illiterate, uneducated. While it's a very, very technical term used at the time of the Prophet by the Jews to refer to those who are not Jews, Gentile. So the exact translation of Ummi would be Gentile.
So the Prophet was a Gentile prophet.
And that's why the Jews could not accept him, because they thought it is impossible that God would send his message or would give his grace to a non-Jew, to a Gentile. And that's why you see this confrontation in Surah Jum'ah. Well, of course, every Muslim is familiar with that. For our non-Muslim viewers, we can just go through the verses. هُوَ الَّذِي بَعَثَ فِي الْأُمِّيِّينَ رَسُولًا مِّنْهُمْ He is the one who has given mission to one of the Gentiles. And then the verse continues to say, this is the grace of God. He can place it wherever he wishes. In a sense, it confronts that idea of monopoly of faith in Jews, and of course God is free to give this grace to anyone he wishes, and here a Gentile, of course.
Now, is supersessionism rooted in the actual fundamental sources of these religions? Is it rooted in the, for example, in the holy books? Is it rooted in the sayings of the prophets? Or is it an attitude, a way of thinking arising from the followers themselves?
I think it's more to do with interpretation of the book. You can read the book in a way that you find very, very supersessionist ideas in it. And you can read it in a different way. It is to do with hermeneutics and how we read the book, actually. So since when you read a Holy Scripture, it always talks about this is the truth, this is the message of God coming
to you. It's the only truth. Yes.
So it gives the sense, that the idea that, well, so everyone should believe in this for salvation.
Right. So now, how do you reconcile then? For example, you know, the Spirit says, I'm the way, Jesus says, I'm the way, the truth, and the light. No one cometh to the Father but by me. And Islam talks about itself as being the religion to supersede or overtake all other religions. How do we understand these statements to be? What should we think them to mean?
Now, you talked about the position of Islam, and I think if we as Muslims could clarify that position for ourselves, then we could probably open a door to dialogue with other faiths, with followers of other faiths, about this issue. I think the position of Islam, with regards especially to Abrahamic faith that we are, of course, concerned with here, is a very unique one. Well, certainly the Quran says that this book supersedes all other books. Not supersede in the sense that whatever is in those books is futile, has no value anymore. It is impossible, because Quran attaches big and great value to what is to the content of those books.
Right.
Although, of course, there are statements in the Quran saying that there are distortions in that. However, still it attaches great value to it. The position of Islam and the Quran about other faiths is that you have to recognize me. Well, this is what the Prophet actually is saying.
Right.
You have to recognize me as the one who is reviving the faith. And if you do not recognize me, then we have to make a compromise. Now, before going to that, I want to elaborate on the concept of religion from the viewpoint of Quran, because that would shed some light on what I want to say about this. From the viewpoint of the Quran, God doesn't have different religions or different faiths. There is only one religion of God. The Quran talks about the religion of God, not religions of God.
Right.
And every prophet has come to preach that one religion, from Adam, peace be on him, coming to Abraham, to Moses, Jesus, Muhammad, peace be on all of them. They all came to preach that one religion of God, which of course is named in the Quran after a terminology which was coined by Abraham, Islam. And of course, Quran clearly mentions there is only one religion of God, and that is Islam. Whoever seeks any religion beside this, it is not going to be accepted from him. However, of course, this is a bit misleading, because people usually identify this with the faith which was, of course, accepted by followers of Muhammad, peace be on him.
So, if the Quran itself says that only one religion would be accepted from mankind, and that religion is Islam, well, isn't this supersessionist? We will see after this news break. Welcome back. We are talking with Sheikh Saeed Bahmanpour, Director of the Islamic College of Advanced Studies of England, on the subject of supersessionism. And we are now about to touch on the question, are certain verses of the Quran supersessionist? Let's see what he has to say.
Sheikh Bahmanpour.
Yeah, what I was saying is that there are some verses in the Quran which talks about the religion of God, and of course names it as Islam. This is usually identified with the Islam which of course was accepted by the followers of Prophet Muhammad, peace be on him. However, the Quran does not use this term as limited as this. It uses the term as the religion of God, a term coined by Abraham, named after his very, very liked attitude of submission to God, which of course he was the hero of, that submitting himself to God, and that's why he called the faith Islam or submission.
So you're talking about two Islams here. We're talking about a universal Islam that embraces all of the truths or the whole truth that God has revealed to mankind over ages, in stages perhaps, and also the particular Islam, which is the Islam of Prophet Muhammad. Am I correct?
Well, these are the residues of that type of understanding. I never talk about different Islams. There is only one Islam. Now, of course, as I said, it is understood in that way, that there are two Islams: Islam, the religion of God, and Islam, religion of Prophet Muhammad. However, this is contradictory. If there is only one religion of God, if we talk about the religion of God, then you can't say there is a universal religion and there is a religion. Yes, of course, usually people refer to Islam as the faith of the followers of Prophet Muhammad. Now, okay, I think that is clear. However, when we talk about this, the religion of God, something which was preached by different prophets, then of course, the religion preached by Jesus, according to the Quran, is exactly the same as the religion preached by Moses, exactly the same as the religion preached by Muhammad. We are not talking about Sharia. Of course, Sharia is important, but we know that Sharia evolves sometimes during the time. Even nowadays, we have lots of discussions about how we have to implement the Sharia, and sometimes we come up in our ijtihad or our legal investigation, our religious investigation, we come to some new ideas that we cannot find, we couldn't find previously in the bulk of the Sharia and tradition. And that's why sometimes you find, for example, codes of Sharia in the religion of Muhammad, peace be on him, that you couldn't find in the religion of Moses, peace be on him, for example. This is not very important. But the main tenets, the main backbone of the faith is the same thing, and that's Islam, submission. Now, if we have this view, then there is no question of supersession at all.
Right.
It's just the same faith preached in different areas, in different locations, to different people. And of course, we regard all these religions to be universal because they are one and the same thing. They are not different things. However, as we discussed previously, there might have been some distortions in the books that passed before. This is the claim which came, of course, by Muhammad, peace be on him, that your books does not contain exactly what Moses preached. It does not contain exactly what Jesus preached. So if you want to know what really was, what really did go into the text of those books and religions, come to this book. I am the benchmark.
Right.
I accept and agree with whatever other faith said, and you could take me as a benchmark, as a yardstick, to judge whether what is in those books are now 100% correct or not.
Now, while we're on the topic of the books, are the books of Christians and Jews, do the books of Christians and Jews contain information or points of view that could neutralize supersessionist attitudes?
I am not very much familiar with details of those books, as I may be familiar with details of the Quran. So let me just concentrate on the Quran and the view that what Quran would teach us about this issue. Certainly, there should have been. I mean, if you take the example of chapter 23 of the Quran, when it talks about the book given to Moses and Aaron, it says that we gave the book to Moses and Aaron as something which distinguished between right and wrong, as a light which guided people, and something which was a reminder for the God-fearing. And then immediately says, and this book is the same type of reminder to people of the world. So the Quran regards all these books, and of course, you know, in different places of the Quran, Allah says, you have to repeat, say, we believe in whatever has been revealed to us, and to Noah, to Abraham, to Moses, to Jesus, to Solomon, to David, we regard all these to be one and the same thing, the same religion, or the religion of God.
Now, what are the characteristics of supersessionist attitudes? I mean, what are the outcomes of supersessionist attitudes?
Well, it's probably closes the door to dialogue. Also, it closes the door to salvation for other faiths. And I know it's a very, very difficult situation for people or followers of any faith to regard some, to accept and to concede some rights for the followers of other religions. But, I mean, if we completely and totally reject followers of other faiths, then we come to a position that, okay, it's only this bunch of followers of this particular faith which have the way and the path to salvation, and others are all just perished creatures of God.
To what extent is this this denial of salvation of faith related to a fear of losing your own religion? Because if you accept another religion as true, it may mean that then you are in danger of the followers of your faith becoming members of that other faith. To what extent is it a defensive reaction psychologically?
Sorry, I don't get the point. What do you want to say?
That when a faith looks at another faith as true,
yeah,
It means then, in a certain sense, it relativizes this particular faith.
Yes.
You know, faith A looks at faith B, and it sees faith B, it says, okay, faith B can be true. Then it means that faith A is relative. It's a relative truth. And being a relative truth, then it opens up the possibility for the followers of that faith to choose.
Yeah.
Based upon their own idiosyncrasies and so forth.
Well, we have universalists who believe that all faiths are equal, and there are different paths going to God. This is one way of looking at it, which of course I don't think, as someone who has read the Quran very extensively, I don't think this would be the position of the Quran.
Right.
Now, the position of the Quran is that, as I said, the Prophet actually announces to Jews and Christians that what I say is a confirmation of your faith. What I say is a confirmation of what came in your books. And therefore you have to recognize me as someone who is a messenger bringing this message, new light, if you wish, to you. So you have to accept me. Now, if you do not recognize and accept me, then I recognize you as having some part of the truth. I think this is, we shouldn't fall in the pitfall of relativism.
Right.
Certain religions usually do not accept relativism.
Right.
Now, the idea which is mentioned in the book, in the Sharia of Islam, about Ahlul Kitab, people of the book. I think this is a very, very important issue, which has legal implications, but its theological implications is even greater, is that you have some part of the truth. And that's why I recognize you. I'm not going to fight with you. If you wish to recognize me as someone, some book, which has brought you the light afresh and a new light, that's, of course, what you have to choose. That's the right thing. Now, if you do not, then I recognize you as people having some part of the truth. If you follow what is in your books, you have a way to salvation. This is very, very important. And I think this is something which traditional Christianity in Judaism could not allow for followers of other
faiths. For themselves. And this is why I was talking about relativism. Yeah. I was talking about relativism with respect to these other religions. Because it seems to me that Islam has an approach that is inclusivistic.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I get the impression that Christianity and Judaism, on the other hand, have almost no choice but to be exclusivistic.
Yes.
Because if they were inclusivistic, it might involve a kind of a relativism in their own attitude to their religions, to their own religions. And therefore, they stand in danger of almost religious suicide,
you know,
losing ground to another religion.
I think nowadays, since faith have more interaction with each other, and of course, we have a smaller world, so to speak, with this huge technology of communication, people are coming to somehow understand each other better. And therefore, nowadays there are theologians in Christianity, like Eckhart and others, who are actually giving some sort of window of hope to followers of other religions. Of course, according to Christianity, if you do not believe that Jesus is Son of God, you are doomed to be perished.
So this is part of the dogma.
This is part of the dogma. And it's very difficult, of course, for Christians to find a way out of this when they come to dialogue with other faiths. Nowadays, of course, there are some sort of theories put forward that, okay, you should believe in Jesus, but believing in Jesus doesn't really mean knowing his name. You might believe in Jesus being a good person and not even knowing his name, and this is confession of Jesus being Son of God. Some sort of ideas, solutions like that. But I agree, I understand, to escape from supersessionism, or to put it in a better term, from exclusivism, from the monopoly of salvation, is much more difficult for Judaism and Christianity than for Islam, which recognizes people of the book as people who have access to at least part of the truth and part of the law of God. There are verses in the Quran, for example, in verse 62 of Surah Baqarah, chapter 2 of the Quran, that Allah says the Jews, Christians, Muslims, Zoroastrians, any one of them who follow their faith and do good, God will give them salvation. This is very, very, of course, categorical and very explicit. Also, in chapter 5 of the Quran, we have these very, very clear verses that people of the Injil or the Gospel have to follow the rules which are in the Gospel. People of the Torah have to follow the rules which are in the Torah. And of course, people of the Quran should follow the rules which are in the Quran. Therefore, although, of course, the Quran does not agree that those religions are parallel to this religion, Islam, as we are speaking about today, because they have lost some identity of the religion of God. However, they have access to some part of the truth, and therefore we can recognize them. There is a way for salvation to them. And if you think about it more clear, more deeply. Now, in Christianity, how many different denominations and sects and groupings do we have?
Countless.
And they do not, of course, accept salvation for each other. Now, come to Islam. Again, in Islam, we have people interpreting the Quran in many different ways, and they do not think that people who interpret in a different, the Quran in a different way, they have access to salvation. So it would be, if we want to go to the root of it, it would be very, very exclusionist. And only a very, very, well, very handful of people would go to paradise at the end. No one would have a way to salvation.
But now you find that among Muslims, you have the emergence of a group called the Takfiris.
Yes.
You know, are they supersessionists with respect to the other Muslims that they disagree with?
I think they are hyper-supersessionists. Because not only they do not accept salvation for people of other faiths, or that people of other faiths might have some part of the truth, even they do not accept it for the followers of the Quran if they do not agree with the interpretation that they give to the Quran. So these are really, really hyper-supersessionists. Super-supersessionists, if you like.
And how do they approach these inclusivistic attitudes towards this within Islam? How do we, in Islam, it is clear that we accept the Christians and the Jews and so forth. How do they relate to those types of ideas and teachings?
Well, what they accept from the Quran with regards to Jews and Christians are just legal, social set of laws which gives them some right myth among the Muslims in their society. However, they wouldn't give them the right to salvation in the hereafter.
I see.
So they are doomed to perdition. However, we regard them as people who are under the protection, the protected people, themis.
I see.
That's the whole thing. Otherwise, they are not allowed, or they are not given salvation by their interpretation of the Quran. And not only they are not given salvation, as I said, all other Muslims who are not agreeing with the type of interpretation that they give to the Quran are doomed to perdition, which of course is, I don't know, would any reason accept this.
Do we have any manifestations of the inclusivistic attitude of Islam in history, in terms of its encounter with other religions, for example, its relationship to other religions that are within the Islamic control? Do you have any examples of the effect of inclusivism, Islamic inclusivism, in history?
Well, of course, the doctrine is always mentioned in the Quran and in traditions. However, practically, the Jews and Christians, specifically Zoroastrians, who were mainly in the eastern part of the Muslim land, they lived very comfortably with Muslims. They were very comfortable, especially the Jews, and it's a very regrettable fact that nowadays, because of Zionism, the relationship between Jews and Muslims have become somehow sore. However, during the history, this relationship has been very, very friendly. The Jews who were persecuted under Christianity sought protection in Islam and in Islamic countries. And the Christians lived very peacefully with Muslims. And this is, of course, possible only when you have a doctrinal background to it. Mm-hmm. When you have a doctrine which gives you this sort of attitude to be lenient towards these faiths. Otherwise, it wouldn't have been possible. And as I said, it's very, very sad that because of Zionism, which is the creation of the the big powers, is a diabolic type of creation, has made this relationship so, of course, antagonistic.
Now, how should we deal with supersessionist or exclusivist ideas and attitudes? What kind of strategies, what kind of approaches should Muslims take with respect to that? Because it seems to me that this Takfiri type of attitude is one that is spreading. Mm-hmm.
Well, you're already doing something, education, and that's the most important thing. And I think maybe the main solution, the main key to the problem is education. I think all these attitudes come out of ignorance, out of wrong interpretations, out of misunderstandings, out of ill-tempered type of attitude which people might develop under ignorance. So the most important and the key to the solution, I think, is right education. And nowadays, of course, with all these communication facilities, this should not be a very difficult job.
A right education. That seems to be the key to dealing with the question of supersessionist attitudes, which, as Mr. Bahman Poor pointed out, are the results of wrong interpretations and incorrect understanding of scriptural passages, which on the surface seem to be exclusivist in tone. Many thanks to Mr. Bahman Poor for his very interesting ideas and appearance on our show. Thank you for watching, and I'll see you right here next week, same time, same channel, here at Press TV on Mimbar.